Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the How's My Hand Path podcast. This week, we are joined by one of the top coaches in the UK by the name of Alistair Davies. For those of you who don't know Alistair, he has his own YouTube channel. He works out of the Forest of Arden out in the UK. And he's been around the game for quite a while. So we talk, about how the instruction world has changed from back then to now, how we prioritize different things in the golf swing. How social media has played a part in the growth of, new and up-and-coming coaches. And it's just a really interesting conversation. So enjoy the show.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, first of all, which golf course are you at right now?
I'm at the Forest of Arden, which is a Marriott resort, basically in the middle of the UK.
Oh, nice. And has your instruction changed at all through the virus? Like, what were you doing during the lockdown to try to keep yourself, I guess, like active within the golf community?
I had to look after my son a lot because my wife went straight back to work. So I was in the daytime, I was nearly with my son. He's only 3 and a half. So I was basically running around after him all the time, and he kept me entertained and frustrated, I think a bit of both. and then when he went to bed, I would be then online doing some YouTube bits, some video editing, some online lessons, so sending videos to people, personal videos back. So every night I was kind of foot to the floor working, and every day I was chasing my son around and doing some stuff around the house. With some family projects we did around the house, and then most of it was running after my son.
We're going to talk about your YouTube channel and stuff like that, because I have quite a few questions for you, which I think are going to be interesting for people who are starting out and like starting to post content online. I think they would love to hear from your perspective. But before we get into any of that, I guess I always do an introduction with everybody who comes on just to hear like how you guys got started in the game. So did you ever have any sort of interest in going pro, or did you kind of know from the beginning you were going into coaching?
More coaching for sure. I didn't really ever think about turning pro. I just wanted to become a club pro. That was always my goal from about 2 or 3 months in from playing. So it was kind of a lifestyle hanging around the golf club I really enjoyed. So I just wanted to be at the golf club or every day, and I thought it was a pretty sweet job, just talking to people about golf and playing golf. So it wasn't so much I had a role model of a tour player that I wanted to be a tour player, and I never got good enough to follow that dream anyway, but it never was my dream.
Yeah. It's funny. I have a very similar story myself. I mean, people ask all the time, like, oh, you're such a good golfer. Why don't you think of going pro? I'm like, if you knew how good these guys are, it was never a thought in my mind at any point. But did you have anyone in your family who was like any sort of accomplished golfer, or you just kind of started on your own?
We all started at the same time. So the whole family started at the same time. My parents started about 3 months before me, purely because we were playing tennis. I was involved in the tennis winter camp. So as soon as we finished our winter coaching for tennis, I started playing golf then in kind of the spring. My parents started in the winter when we were at tennis. They went for golf lessons. But we all started at the same time. And as we all got the bug pretty much at the same time, we all just made it our weekend thing. And then I wanted to do it every day, but school got in the way. But we all got hooked on it and all just wanted to just play golf all the time as a family. It was pretty cool.
That's a good way to stay together with everyone at the same time. It's a great activity to share amongst people. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who would agree with that part of it.
Yeah.
What was the first step you did then into trying to become a coach? Was it just through working at a club that you just kind of got into it?
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. I basically went down the route. I got a job in the club when I was 15, left school at 16, and then basically started my apprenticeship, if you want to call it that, at a golf club. And then as soon as I got my handicap low enough, in the UK, you have to be 4 handicap or below to start your professional training, your PGA training.
Right.
So as soon as I got down to 4, I turned pro, and then started my training. And as soon as I started teaching that, turned pro, then I started teaching the same time. But my boss at the time was a successful coach, albeit very old school. But he was great with people. So I learned a lot from him from that aspect of it, I would say. A great human being, great with people, and he had a very good reputation of being a good coach, even though he's probably, as I would look at it now, more of a kind of a little impart and quick fix kind of coach more so. So definitely different to how I try to be, but I definitely learned a lot from him, in lots of aspects around coaching as well as people. So that got me into it, and as soon as I started coaching them, really I just wanted to do more, learn more, and I wanted that to be, definitely a huge part of whatever I was going to do going forward.
It's funny because I get that question a lot of, you know, what differs, let's say, a swing coach from 20 years ago to now? And despite the fact that maybe obviously there's some information that's been disproven that we clearly no longer are telling the student that's in front of us, like those coaches were as good as us in terms of communication, if not better, right? Like if anything, they were probably better speakers because they had less data to rely on that they can transfer over to the student to try to justify their message. So it's almost like, you know, you really have to have confidence when you're talking and you really have to be a good speaker to kind of prove to your student, because you don't have those numbers behind you to be like, hey, if you don't believe me, just look at this. This is what it's telling you, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. You know, his main skill, if I looked at him, he would command the area for half an hour with a student. There's a lot of half an hour lessons he used to give, but he'd be commanding a lesson for half an hour. The person always come away with something that they thought was the secret or the magic that's going to make them play better. Even if it was just a tiny grip tweak, you know, regardless of how else they moved or something, working on the rhythm or something very small and minute, but they enjoyed the experience of spending time with him and they felt they got better. And you know, he had no video, no Trackman launch monitors, anything like that. It was just pure old good communication and relationship building.
It's the best way to go about it. Did you have any golfer idols growing up, or it was just kind of like you just followed the professional world but didn't really care for one specific player?
I had a hero, if you know, someone I looked up to in terms of playing. It was Ian Woosnam, because I'm a Welsh guy. So mm-hmm. He was world number one, I think, in about my second year of playing. So I was always looking for his results because he was the only really Welsh guy on tour at the time, I think. And when he became world number one and then won the Masters, you know, within the next so many years, or I think he might win the Masters before he became world number one, but he was always my golfing hero. And from a coaching point of view, really, when I started coaching, what I would call properly, Pete Cowan was always my kind of role model within coaching.
Yeah, I would imagine that Pete, being from that area, must have like a huge influence on coaches in the UK. Just based on, I mean, have you ever shadowed him or spoken to him and stuff like that? He's helped you out a ton, I would imagine.
Yeah, I'm quite lucky with where I work. We had like a training budget and Pete came in and did about 4 to 5 days with us in a small group. So Pete came in and spent, I think we did like a couple of days a year for 3 years or so. And he would come in and just go through all his philosophies, videos of players he was working with at the time, which was Westwood and Darren Clark mostly. And then he'd come in and say, got this is how I'm teaching chip in now, this is how I'm doing bunker play now. And he would just go through kind of everything. Then we'd watch him teach one of the other guys that was on the little course. This is like six of us there, whatever it would be. And he'd have a look at our swings and go through it on video and tell us what he thought. So we got the chance to kind of shadow him through that. I also had a lesson with Ledbetter myself around that sort of time. And I watched a few other coaches like Dennis Sheehy teach. Not a lot, but I watched Dennis once, and we had a lot of training with psychologists. We had a lot of training with people like Tim Barter, who's on obviously a tour coach and tour commentator. Mm. And we had Claude Harmon come in. So we had various different peoples coming in different backgrounds that all shared something. And, you know, the way I looked at it, I tried to pick up different things from different people and you know, merge it all together to what I saw as my philosophy stroke models and things, and obviously learn as you go along. It's easier now, I think, because of all the internet stuff that you can, you know, go online and see something you're doing and think, okay, I like that, so I'll take bits of this and take bits of you, see someone else is doing and do the same thing. So it kind of helps challenge me, I think, to try and research new things, especially if I see something that I haven't seen before or something that challenges my thinking.
I think that's a commonality among a lot of coaches nowadays, which is where, you know, I would say that I don't even know if I learned necessarily more about the golf swing online, but I learned way more about how to talk to students, what kind of drills I should be using. You know, if a player is struggling with a certain movement, you might see a coach using a drill that you've never thought of, and you're like, oh, fuck, maybe I should be using a drill similar to that. And I've probably done that even with your videos, to be completely honest. I mean, where, you know, you're the guy who posts so many different exercises of so many different issues that I've seen on the internet that I'm like, man, there's always going to be one that I can use that I haven't seen in the past that I probably use to this day, you know?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, exactly that. I might see someone doing the drill on Instagram. I think, okay, I like that, but how could I do it differently? What else could I do with it? And I try and think a bit outside the box. Sometimes I purely just take it on board what they've done and copy it and use it. And then when using it, I think, okay, how about if we did it this way? And I try and think if there's a different version or a different use for it. And obviously, since I've been coaching what I would call properly, I'm lucky I've always worked with a lot of coaches. So what I mean by that is that I worked at the Belfry for 17 years. And at the Belfry, at one stage, we had 27 pros.
Wow.
So a lot of those pros weren't allowed to coach because they were trainee pros. Like a few of them would be taking lessons. So you'd be looking at what they were doing with their golf swings, how they were working on it, who they were working with as a coach. But all the ones that were coaching, there was probably about 10 of us at the peak time. You'd be watching someone work 3 bays along from you and see, well, why is he doing that with that guy? And then you'd be thinking, okay, what can I, how could I use that? Or why is that good? Why is that going to help? And sometimes you think it was a waste of time. But sometimes you think, okay, there's a little nugget I can take from that. And you try and do it. Or you might ask them afterwards, what are we doing with that? If they're more experienced than you, especially, you know,
I mean,
it's great having that big environment.
Yeah. Well, first of all, if you have that many coaches around you at all times, you're always going to be learning just by looking around. Right. And I try to tell people this all the time. Like, there are going to be people who message me and be like, oh, well, this guy, this coach is not that great on the internet, or this guy maybe is producing information that I'm not a big fan of. I'm like, well, look, as a coach, you can learn from every single person because either you're going to like what they have to say and you can take that with you, or maybe you don't like the way they communicated the information and you can find a different way to communicate it maybe better because you have the experience in front of you with something that you didn't like. So even if there's coaches around you that maybe have shared information, and I'm sure you've dealt with a bunch of people at the Belfry that probably said something to a student where you're like, I don't know if that's the way I would have gone about it, but at least you did learn right there and then, like, hey, I would have gone about this differently. And it starts getting your brain kind of working, you know, in a different way.
Exactly that, you know, and I think the more obscure information you see or hear, or even something online you see or hear, you think, well, I really don't like that. It challenges you to think why you don't like it and what then do you like? And it challenges you to think about, you know, what you need to do instead, you know? So for me, if it's different information, I quite like that because it challenges me. If it's stuff I see that I think is just the same that I would do it, I think, well, yeah, that's, it's nice. It's nice to see that another top coach is saying the same things as I would do. But it, I don't learn from that. It just gives a bit of a pat on the back and you think, okay, we're on the same page, which is lovely. But you know, sometimes it's nice for someone to use some language or something or some data that you haven't used or some equipment you haven't used, and you think, oh God, I need to learn a bit more about that because I don't think I know enough about that little bit to really represent what it does.
Right. Have you been to the US for golf already for work-related reasons?
I've been there. I've been there for a conference and I've been there on holiday golfing. I went there to the American Teaching Conference back in 2006. Makes me feel a bit old. And I've been there on holiday a few times. And when I've been on holiday, I dropped in with Rob Neal once for a couple of days when I was on holiday.
I was going to ask if you have noticed any like big differences between golf, the golf community in the US or in North America, let's say, versus the golf community in the UK. Do people treat it or look about it differently?
I think it's less so now. I think the early stuff I saw in America was very much more, especially from coaches, was very much more about impact only. You used to see a lot of coaches in America doing stuff that they weren't too bothered about, how they stood to the ball, how they set up to the ball, or how their backswing was. They just really wanted that flat left wrist, you know, through impact and, you know, pressure on the ball. And that's what the big focus was always on. The coaches who spoke and the coaches that I saw, that's very much the way I felt they were wired. Whereas now, especially the younger breed of coaches, I'd probably call them now, you see them, a lot of them talking about obviously matchups and structures and setups and backswing cause and effect, which is the same way I've always thought. So I would definitely say it looks like America, and it might have always been the same, I just wasn't exposed to the right people, very much more down the same way the European coaches tend to be, much more way, which is very much about getting the fundamentals and trying to get the backswing right and matching up, you know, the things, how they would move, and getting more technical orthodox. Whereas I've always felt with a lot of the American players that have done well, have had much more quirkier swings, but produced great golf. Whereas a lot of the Europeans tend to be a bit more what I would class as orthodox, or, you know, nearer to what we class as on plane, if you want to call it that. And, you know, they set up to the ball similarly, especially if you look at like the Swedes, the Scandinavians and people like that.
The infamous word of on plane. We're going to get to that part too.
Okay.
Do you think right now we're kind of in a distance era because everybody's just mashing the ball a million yards on the tour?
Yeah, I think that's the way it's going to go even more. You know, if you just look at the players that are successful, they all hit it, you know, a long, long way. And I think it's the way it's going. If you can hit it a long, long way and basically hit good wedge shots and putt, you're going to be successful. So I think unless the courses get a bit tighter, then I think it's good. It's the way they're going to go. And why shouldn't they be? You know, if you can hit it a long way, if you're hitting a wedge out of the rough, even it's not too bad.
Yeah.
If you're trying to hit a 4-iron out of rough, obviously it's hard work. So certainly all the young players I teach now that want to play, I'm saying to them, you've got to be hitting it over 300 yards really, by the time you're 18 to 22 really.
Mm-hmm. If you want to be able to keep competing with the younger guys coming up.
Yeah. If they want to just play regional stuff like we would class over here, then they don't need to be that long because the courses won't be that long. But if they want to go and play PGA Tour or European Tour, I think they're going to have to be 300 yards plus going forward. And, you know, whether how long that actually gets, they need to be, I think it depends on what happens in the next few years. But, you know, if you look at Bryson now, he's smashing it miles and hitting it straight.
Yeah, so, that's a good combination. Yeah. Do you see those priorities differently on the European Tour, or is it very much the same thing right now?
I'd say it's the same. I think there's just less people. You know, Bryson's obviously a bit of a game changer right now, isn't he? You know, the way he's changed his body and trying to smash it a long way, but still hitting it straight. Mm-hmm. There's guys that have always hit it a long way on the European Tour, but there's a handful. I think ever since Tiger really came out, the big change in the European Tour happened back in whenever it was 20 odd years ago, that the physio unit started getting used every day by every player. Whereas guys used to go on the tour 20 years ago, they said they went on the tour truck and all the physios would be sat around just reading the paper, and there'd be covers over all the machines and stuff because people wouldn't be using them. They weren't really interested in using it. And ever since Tiger came and hit it obviously a long way and was doing a lot of gym work, the physio unit started to become busy on the European Tour. And then what you see now with the European Tour is that the new young players are coming out. You know, they all hit it a long way. They're super, super good, but they hit it a long way as well.
Do you prioritize different things differently when you're working with, let's say, a tour player or someone who's a little more on the recreational side?
I try and basically do it person to person, regardless of what their kind of goal is. I try and look at what they want to achieve each session to start with. If someone's committing to be more long-term with me and I know that, then obviously I can try and set out more of a pathway. But quite often when people come, I don't know if you get the same, I get a lot of people that might only come once or twice, then they might disappear.
Yeah, so, I get that too.
So I'm basically just trying to get an idea of, you know, what's going to make this person happy, what's their goals for that first session really. And then within that first session, I try and lay out the pathway that I would take them on and the reasons behind why I take them on that pathway. So the changes I would make and why I'd make them, not just, I'd like to see you in a better position on your backswing. It'd be a case of, okay, these are the things I think you could do. This is why I think you need to change this move. And this is how this will make it easier. Whether that be to help their physicality as well, you know, so injuries, or whether it's just to get them to have less manipulation through impact really. So they get more consistent or get more power or whatever it is. But if they come to me as a blank project and just say to me, I want to be a tour player and this is where I am, I'll very much look at them and go, okay, well, at the moment, you need to hit it 20 yards further. So right. We need to look at how we're going to get that. And then if they're keen enough, then I'll lay out a team that I would use for them to help that as well. So I'd have a physical guy, a psychologist, a 3D guy. So depending on how keen they are, I'll lay out then the full stuff that I would do for support. And then...
Interesting. So you do have a group of people around you to prep them if they do need to have the extra help in different areas.
Yeah. I've had that for about probably 15 years. And I've tried various different programs to try and get people on board with it. And it worked for a few years when I had a group of young players all very keen to do it. And then once I lost that kind of group of young players, they got older and so on, it doesn't really work. So it's more a case of now I just refer people. I just say, look, if I think we need to get you to make this move, and if you can't do it physically, then we need to get you to go and get someone to look at you physically. Then I say, this is my recommendation. And if they don't do it, I just treat them as best I can. You know, I coach them the best way I can and work around the problem or give them some advice that I would give them to help do it.
Right. I mean, that's a good strategy because I would imagine that it's hard to try to get people on a program of so many different people around them that they don't necessarily know already. Right. Yeah. And then you're like, hey, you should go see this specific person and this specific person. But then they're like, what if I don't need the help in that area? Why do I have to go see them? You know?
Yeah. They don't always value the help in that area. And that's the problem you get, especially with younger people. That's what I found years ago. So the program I did originally years ago, it was a case of I controlled it. So they paid me a fund of money, if you like. And then from that, I laid out a template that would include so many sessions, like with a 3D guy. And then when I was working with a player, if I thought he needed more, I'd take money from another pot to go into that 3D pot, and we'd send him there and say, right, you're going to go and see Mark Bull. You're going to see him four times. And then you're going to see the physio. The physio says he needs to see you eight times, so there'll be more budget going into there. So I tried to control the budget, but had a template and outline of what I thought was right from the start, and then made it more individual. And it kind of worked for a couple of years, as I said, but then when you have people that don't know if they're going to see you for more than three lessons or six lessons or 10 lessons, it's hard to get them to commit a pot of money up front.
Right.
That's what I always found.
That's understandable. I mean, I would imagine that the only people who would ever consider doing that kind of project seriously would be a tour player or someone who's already envisioning long-term growth.
Yeah. Mine was called, it was called a tour. I can't remember what I called it now. It was called a tour player kind of package. And it was basically ideally designed at, like, you know, 18-year-old kids, 16 to 18-year-old kids that wanted to play for a living. And it covered all the support from me watching them play, from the 3D, from psychological. There was about three psychological sessions in there. There was three 3D sessions in there. There was four physio sessions in there. There was a strength conditioning pot in there. And then basically we'd also sit down and go through the periodization with them and plan out practice rounds, how to do practice rounds, how to do, you know, course mapping at the time, all the things with less obviously apps available to do some of the stuff that you can do now. But it was that kind of project, really. And so it was successful for a few years. And I also used to run a college program, which helped support that too. So the college program was 16 to 18. And then those kids, if they wanted them to go on to something, they could go on to this program from 18 to 20 or 18 to 19. And then if they felt they weren't getting there, they'd go and get a job.
Interesting. I like that, because I've always looked at coaching much more individualistic, in the sense where, you know, I kind of am where you are now, I guess, where you have all those people still as a team to support you, but I would just refer them to one specific area if I see that they're struggling in that area.
Yeah, it's kind of exactly how I do it now, purely because I've tried the other way. And I think I tried 2 years ago, tried to get a facility where I could get everyone working together at the same facility. And that was the kind of the dream. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty impossible to do when you want the right people, because the right people won't move, you know, locations just to try and support a dream unless you can guarantee them a salary. So, you know, what I did used to do with Mark Bull, for example, I probably worked with Mark Bull 15 days a year for about 8 years, 8 to 10 years. And we used to just do days together where we'd have people come and see us at the same time. I used to have a few people I'd send to see him individually. And then I'd have days where he'd come in and work with my college, where, you know, obviously we'd brainstorm a lot of the stuff as well. And we used to do the same with the physio, and I used to get the physio and him there the same days. So the idea was the physio could talk to Mark about the screening physically. He could talk to him about the 3D screening, if you like, or the 3D movement patterns. And then us as coaches would sit in and give our feedback on what we wanted the player to do, and we try and come up with a bit of a plan.
I like that. I like that a lot. And for those who don't know, Mark Bull is like one of the best 3D guys pretty much out there.
Yeah. I've known Mark for about 18, 20 years now. He's a good friend of mine. You know, I'm very lucky. You know, I pick his brains whenever I want to. Mm-hmm. He's good as gold with me. I got him in with the Welsh Golfing Union. So does the Welsh 3D. That was through my recommendation, and he's ever grateful for that. But he's obviously in the States now a lot, so I don't see him as much as I used to. But when he's back in the UK, the plan is to again put on a few days a year now where he'll come up and work with some of my students, and I'll just advertise it out to whichever students want to come along, and they'll share like an hour and a half or 2 hours with me and him at the same time, and I get to pick his brains. It's great for me, because I'm getting paid in theory to learn from him and help my students.
Right.
So it's kind of
a win-win.
Yeah. And he's great. He's a great guy. He's definitely changed, but he's a great guy. He used to be much more into the physical side of things, I would say. Now he's much more into the learning side of things.
Mm-hmm. Is there a reason why you think his mentality changed?
I think it's probably some of the people he's been around. Some of the coaches he's been more around in the last few years have definitely challenged him a little bit more that way, I think. When you talk to him, he says Sean Foley's definitely challenges him, and you know, he enjoys that. He enjoys that mental stimulation, but also his PhD and his learning and doing the university stuff that he's done has made him a lot more, I think, around the thinking and the learning style and things like that. Whereas in the past, he used to spend a lot of time with Ramsey McMaster, which is very much the physio side of things, and a lot of the physical drills, doing a lot of like tubing drills and movement pattern drills. Whereas now I think he's a little bit more down how the brain's wired and how people are wired and how people learn to try and get the same response. And he still does the physical drills, but you just see, I think you see a little bit that he's definitely more educated now. And you know, he comes at it very much like a professor would come at things now, rather than the golf coach would have come at it, I would say.
And for those who don't know, like Sean Foley is one of those guys who very much teaches with a lot of critical thinking involved.
Yeah. Whenever I listen to Sean Foley, I think I need to go and read a book. I haven't spent a lot of time with him at all. I've never met him, but obviously Mark, I've spoken to Mark about him a few times, but every time I listen to an interview he's done or anything, I just think I need to go and do some reading because he uses words that I wouldn't use. And he talks again, like he's been to university. He talks like he's massively more educated than I am.
Well, he is than a lot of us. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So let's talk about YouTube now. 30,000 plus subscribers. You post videos pretty much on a weekly basis. Is there something that happened that caused you to start the channel, or did you just come up with that of saying there's not enough info on the internet?
No, it was definitely something that happened. I'm good friends with Me and My Golf, who are obviously one of the biggest out there.
Yep.
So Me and My Golf talked to me quite a few times about what they were doing with their YouTube channel. We talked about what it did for them, obviously from a value perspective, you know, obviously agreeing with some income. Yep. I was obviously at the time a very busy coach, and I was thinking, well, when I'm not coaching, you know, I'm not doing anything to enhance my revenue. So I thought, okay, I need to look at the YouTube as a business, which is what I did, quite being quite honest about it. And then when I started doing it, I kind of enjoyed the process of doing it. I quite enjoyed sharing the videos. So I've always been keen to share the videos and information to kind of students and amateur golfers. But the YouTube channel at the start, before I started, I was thinking, you know, why would I do it? What was the value behind doing it? So once I saw it as a kind of a business.
It is a revenue stream at the end of the day.
Yeah. And that's purely why I started it, to be honest, was to try and gain some, obviously, revenue when I'm not coaching. Because I thought when I get older, I don't want to necessarily be on the range 50 hours a week. The idea is to always coach because I love it and I would never not coach. But the idea is to try and create some of that residual income. And also then I've enjoyed the journey of learning how to do it. That's been the biggest journey for me with it, I think. I've enjoyed trying to find content to put on and research some content to go on. And that's made me look at some other coaches, which has helped me, again, learn from a technical perspective. So again, when I look at like your stuff online, I look at other people's stuff online, it helps me think about how to present things. It helps me think about subject areas. And then what I've enjoyed doing as well is learning how to edit videos, how to film, learning about the equipment and software you need. It's been, you know, a challenge to learn how to do it. And I think we all need to keep learning things, whatever that is, whether it's a new hobby, new sport, golf, whatever it is, whatever you're doing. Obviously for me, I hardly ever play golf anymore. And I haven't been to like teaching conferences for a while. It's something I want to get back into is going and doing a bit more monitoring and shadowing coaches, probably out in the States. In the future, obviously with this lockdown has made that harder, but that was the kind of plan end of this year to go maybe out and do some of that.
Yeah.
But the learning journey of trying to produce videos, I've really enjoyed and still enjoy learning how to do it. And, you know, trying to learn from other people in the outside fields as well, you know, how to produce videos, camera equipment, all that kind of stuff.
Outside of shadowing, I tell all these young coaches, I think what made me learn the most about the golf swing was honestly producing content, because you have to do so much research and it makes you such a better communicator that like there's so much value to be gained from putting yourself in front of a camera and talking and then learning to talk with confidence where people are willing to believe it. Because I mean, you're not always going to be able to prove things scientifically unless you can, you know, communicate it in a good way. And I mean, I'm sure, like, for example, your first video that you put out, I'm sure you look back at it now and you're cringing of going like, what the hell was I saying? And why was I talking about this?
Yeah, when I look at my first few, actually the technical content I'm not that embarrassed about. It's more things like the presentation skills, and the quality of the video, so the quality of the camera work, the quality of the audio and things like that is awful. Some of the drills and things like that I still use to this day that I did in my first few videos, but the titles were awful and all this kinds of stuff, and the production quality was awful. awful.
Do you remember the first video you ever filmed?
Yeah, I think I do. Yeah, I think it was on Handpath and Takeaway.
I'll tell you what, as a first video, that's already way more complex and scientific than I would have imagined it to be.
Yeah, but I think that's where I kind of went wrong because no one searches for Handpath. It wasn't called that. It was called something like how does it start the golf swing or your takeaway.
Yeah.
But the problem I have with it is it makes the audience much more niche because it's probably too technical. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the problem. The first kind of 50 videos I do were probably poor production and probably too technical for the bigger audiences.
You can't gain that traction just when you're getting started.
No, it would have gone down far better on Instagram, but on YouTube, the audience is much older. The average audience is probably about 55 years of age.
So that's kind of what some of my follow-up questions were, is like, what kind of audience and feedback are you getting from your videos? Cause I would imagine that market is completely different than Instagram.
Yeah. The feedback I get generally is good. So a lot of people will like the videos or the technical content generally. Obviously, the more views you get, the more comments you get, and then you get more bad comments as well as good comments.
Yep, but, it goes both ways.
But at the moment, because of the amount of views I get per video, the feedback I get generally is good. Some people obviously want it to be a bit snappier. They want less talking, more action. That's probably as about as negative as it gets. Mm-hmm. But the audience is mostly American. It's 42% American.
Oh, interesting.
And the biggest age range is 45 to 60. And then if you look within that in America, a lot of it's California and Florida and Texas.
A lot of the big golfing states in the US is where your market's coming from.
Yeah. So a lot around those states, and obviously stuff I do on Instagram is much more, I get a lot of Korean stuff on Instagram. You probably do too.
Oh yeah. Big time. Actually, I was going to say, I think my biggest market of people outside of Canada and US is South Korea.
Yeah. On Instagram it is for me, but on YouTube, I'm not sure if they get YouTube in Korea, if they're allowed to access it or not. But there's not a big following on YouTube for Korea. Mm-hmm.
But it's huge on Instagram for sure.
Yeah. It's my biggest city is Seoul. I think it is.
Yep. Me too.
And then my biggest city is probably, my biggest country is America, but biggest city is Seoul. So it's interesting, isn't it? It's different. It's a younger audience. It's a different geographic to it. And I enjoy doing content on both. You know, I try and obviously do different stuff for both, but it's pretty hard to do. Sometimes you just put a clip of what you're doing on YouTube on Instagram just to help both channels, really. But the YouTube side of things is definitely, it feels sometimes harder to grow than it does on Instagram because I think it's longer videos and people have to, there's more people doing it, so it's harder to find the videos.
Yeah.
But it's definitely something I'd recommend, as you said, to any young coach out there that wants to go and practice, you know, delivering what they believe in. So get it down in the head what they need to say and how they need to say it. I think it's a really good exercise to do. I lecture pros in the UK, so I'm part of the PGA training in the UK. So I lecture people on how to get through the coaching badges. And we always talk about videoing themselves and creating voice notes to try and practice for the presentations when they're doing the explanation demonstrations. So I think it's a vital lesson in terms of delivery. And also it makes you, if you're going to say something, you have to try and make sure you understand it.
Oh yeah. Cause they're going to ask questions and you're going to need to have an answer to those questions.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the way, what we definitely recommend is a vital exercise. If someone's going to coach out there, it's, you know, understand what you want to coach and why. Don't be scared to obviously adapt things, but it's great exercise to video yourself or create some voice notes or a podcast on what you believe in. So you'll have to be really sure what you're talking about.
So that leads kind of to my next question is, how have you changed your coaching over the last 10 years? Like, are you teaching drastically different things because of the adaptation of launch monitors and stuff?
I think it's slowly adapted. Yeah. I don't think it's adapted massively because of launch monitors.
Interesting. Okay.
I think I use more launch monitors for me as showing students the evidence of change.
That's so funny you say that, because people ask me all the time, why do you use launch monitors so much for my students? And I say, honestly, it's just to justify the change we're making, because you see an actual quantifiable change taking place on the numbers.
Yeah, it's exactly how I would tend to use it. I tend to use it as a benchmark at the start. So I'll say to someone, okay, you're cutting across the ball 6 degrees. Let's look at the video and see why you're doing it. And I would already watch them moving, obviously, but I'll say, this is the reason why you do it. Let's work on this move. And then you see how the path has changed afterwards. So I tend to use it as a kind of a before and after.
And that's so funny, dude. That's exactly the way I think about it.
And quite often they'll make a move and you'll be the same with this. They'll make a move. That feels wrong. And I'll show them both the video of what the new move looks like and then the data. And then they'll say, oh, okay.
Yeah, like it's kind of hard to argue when like your path is getting less outside in and like the video proof of it is changed. Like it could feel as weird as hell to you, but it's clearly what you need to be working on.
Yeah. I think in terms of coaching, I think, what have I changed? I probably changed positions that I used to teach, the positions I do now subtly. Mm-hmm. And I think I hear Pete Cowan talking about this the other day, that he's changed how he wants the club face to be in takeaway and how he wants the club face to be in delivery, because he says you need to hit it further now. So he's got it in a much stronger position in both.
Yeah, you need more compression, less spin, let's rip it.
Yeah, and I think I'm definitely the same. I probably like to see swings probably, I'm not that fussed if it's going to be an A set position. There's probably windows of positions I like things to be in.
Yeah.
I probably like to see more tilts in the body now than I used to, maybe.
But yeah, I think that would be fair to say. I think there's a lot of talk, especially lately, about like pelvic tilts and, you know, what the upper body and the torso is doing in transition and stuff like that to make sure you don't, you know. I think that the biggest change that I've noticed probably over the last 10 years is that people are trying to remove a lot more side bend to the golfer on the downside.
Yeah. So I think it's kind of a subtle model. You know, I said I was quite lucky. I had Pete Cowan. I was in my last year of training when Pete Cowan started his training with us at the Barfrey. So I used to very much, you know, teach the same things he would teach, you know, from an early start to my career. And then I would try, and then if I saw something another coach had done and I thought, well, why is he doing that? And I'd have a think about it, or I'd ask a question. I would adapt it a little bit to be that way, whether it was making it a bit more one planey or whether it'd be a bit more of kind of more centered pivot or whatever it would be. And then I try and be adaptable to the players then, you know, so depending on what I feel the player needs, I might try and teach them, you know, bits and pieces from different models, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. And I think just realistically, I probably got the club face in a stronger position for the last few years in terms of that. I used to, like 15, 20 years ago, I probably used to teach a very fixed right knee in the backswing.
Mm-hmm. I think that was the case for a lot of coaches back then.
I think everybody was doing that back then, you know, Ledbetter stuff, you know, back in the day he was teaching it, for example. And it was definitely what I used to teach, you know, resist in the backswing as much as you can and then let it go on the way down. Whereas now I'm very much totally the opposite to that, I'd say. You know, let the hips move, let the right knee work straighter, mm-hmm. you know, be more resistance free, and then resist a bit more in the kind of downswing, and then explode, if you like.
Go for it.
Go on, sorry.
No, go, dude. Finish what you were saying.
I was just going to say, I don't think I've changed massively in terms of the technical positions. I've probably just tried to evolve a little bit more as a presenter, maybe, I think, and how people learn a little bit, maybe, I don't know. I've tried to be less strict on terms of, right, you've got to go and see this physio to make us get where you are, and a little bit more relaxed on that kind of things.
I think those are all very fair, given the changes that most people have gone through in coaching over the last 10 years, to be honest.
Yeah.
Do you have a big pet peeve in regards to golf instructors right now? Like, is there something that bothers you when you see it online that you're like, yeah, people should not be saying this or doing this?
Let me think. I don't think there's anything major. Obviously, I hate the old head down stuff, but not many people are saying that anymore.
Thankfully, not many. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. I don't like people saying too much when they say, you know, try and release the club really early, things like that. So, you know, there's so many flippers out there in this world.
Yeah.
You know, 90% of the amateurs I'd see flip too early. I'm not saying you shouldn't have a hand release, but, and a hand going into extension, but so many people get so scared of a ham and shaft lean, for example, that, you know, and yet 90% of the golfers on tour would still only have good shaft lean, not too much. Mm-hmm. And nearly every amateur I would teach would not have enough shaft lean, for example. So, you know, and people thinking that they need to try and, you know, flip the right arm through the golf ball. You hear a lot of people sort of talking about that, you know, keeping the body still and letting the arms flip. So I probably am against that, even though it has its place for some students. Because globally I would think it would do more people more harm than good.
Right. There's a majority of golfers that don't need to be hearing that kind of information, basically.
Yeah. it is usable for probably 1%. And I've definitely told people to have that kind of feel who do get too much sharpening, but I probably had one or two students in my career of 22 years that have been that way.
It's funny because I've been working with this pro out in Vancouver who tends to deliver way too much shaffling. And literally a lot of the work that we've done over the last like year, and he's improved his ball striking immensely, is literally to like feel like he's turning while actually early releasing the club hard. Yeah. And so he's doing all these like, you know, rehearsals where he's stalling his body and like throwing the hands as much as possible. And yeah. Then he goes, how come you never post my stuff on Instagram? I'm like, because if I post this information on Instagram, I'm going to get murdered.
Yeah. Well, I had a student yesterday I'm doing exactly the same with. I'm getting him to keep his back to target as long as he can and throw his right arm as quickly as he can. And try and feel it, the butt of the club points outside his right leg at contact. Mm-hmm. But he's never made one swing in his life where he does that.
Right. And that's exactly the same with mine. It's one of those things where he needs that feel to offset what he's doing. But the masses on the internet do not need to see or hear that.
No, but you get that. You get people come in and say, you know, I had a guy come for a lesson the other week. He said, I've got this swing problem. I just try and basically let my right hand overtake just prior to impact. And I'm thinking, you know, that's probably the worst thing you can tell any amateur. I'll wait till I see what you move like first, but it's probably the worst thing you can ever do. And he said, I played great with it. So they hit it really straight. I don't know what he was like before he got told that information to be able to justify whether that was the right thing or not. But I very much doubt it. You know, he's playing off like 14 and only hits the ball probably 108 yards. So I can't imagine he had too much shuffling in the first place or too much narrowing of the arc on the way down.
Right. It was probably just a feel that happened to give him that happy medium that day for the timing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's fair to say.
Well, that would probably be only about it. You know, as I said earlier, I probably like things that are different and challenging because it would make me think. I think sometimes we make things too complex.
Right.
You know, I'm not massively into the alpha, beta, and gamma stuff. I don't fully.
That's fair. To be honest, I also don't think that that's the kind of information that regular recreational golfers are ever going to benefit from.
Yeah, I can't see. I've not looked into it too much. I've watched a few videos on it and looked at a few pieces on it, but I can't see me ever using it with a golfer.
Right.
So I think I don't need to understand it too as much as I would want to understand it. Mm-hmm. You know, in order to be able to talk about it. You know, I've put a plane in my club and I've had a little look at it and tried to have a fiddle around and feel it. I would just use different terminology.
And you know what's the worst part? In your case, let's say you're probably already talking about it, but just differently without those terms.
Yeah, I would say 100%. There's nothing I see different with the movement that's been described there, but I would just never think of it that way. If someone asked me to try and demonstrate alpha force in a downswing,
You're talking about twisting the grip and applying a force to the handle that you're like, I already talk about this. I'm just not using those turds.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fair. Well, dude, I want to leave you with two questions. And they're not as scientific since we've been talking so much instruction. The first one is, if you could go back and rewatch any tournament, is there anything specific that stands out for you that you would love to see again?
The Masters, the Ryder Cup, the two things I love watching. I don't watch a lot of other golf, but those two things, I think. So probably...
Woosnam at the Masters?
Woosnam at the Masters and Sandy Lyle at the Masters were big ones for me. I was a young kid, stayed up all night to watch them. They were the two big ones that I loved, got excited about and nervous about.
That's the thing, right? Is that as soon as you start feeling nervous for a player, you can tell that you have that much more genuine interest in it.
Yeah. Woosnam was the big one, but Sandy Lyle was a big one before that, to be fair, because I think he was the first Brit for a long, long time.
So it was huge for the UK, basically, back then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who's playing in your dream foursome, past or present?
It'd have to be Tiger.
Right. I think 100% of people who have been on the show has said Tiger.
Have to be Tiger. It'd probably be Woosnam. That's one.
Right.
And then maybe someone like Jack Nicklaus.
That's a group that I would not want to hit the first tee ball in front of. Let's put it that way.
No, definitely not.
That's awesome. Well, dude, I appreciate you coming on, man. I know that, you know, there's a lot of people that would love to hear from your perspective because you've been obviously teaching the game for a long time and, you know, you share content on the internet that's very different than what people are talking about. So I appreciate you, spreading some knowledge here.
Thank you. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Thanks, Dan. See you soon.
So we hope you guys enjoyed the show.
Just some final notes here. As always, be sure to subscribe to the pod if you haven't. Leave a review. Let us know if there's anything you would like to hear differently on the show in terms of maybe a guest or a certain topic in the game of golf. You know, you can always check us out at Max Giovanni Golf or Shkeen Golf on our Instagram handles or on my own personal Twitter page as well. And next week will be our monthly mailbag episode. So we might have said that last week in regards to this week, but we got caught up with a couple things going on. So a couple projects that we're excited to release eventually. But yeah, so next week is our monthly mailbag episode. We also have Ed Watson on the show, Mr. Teddy, one of my good friends, who is the creator of Watson Golf. For those of you who have ever tried the training aid of the Hanger, he has a new product that was just released this year, and it's going to be another fun episode. So stay tuned for that one, and we hope you guys have a good week.